when we think of the issue of suffering, certainly in the light of September the 11th, where a certain degree of innocence was snuffed out when those towers fell and the horrific attacks that were experienced in the city of New York and in Washington, D.C. Now, the question that is an age-old question, why suffering? What's the point of it? Why is the words of a great author, Jewish fellow, I can't remember his name, perhaps somebody can help me with this, but the title of his book is, why do bad things happen to good people? It's a fair question. It's a question that everybody has asked from day one of human existence. Good people, people who seemingly are innocent of evil or sin in the most horrific kinds of ways, and yet, on the other hand, the wicked seem to prosper. There's a psalm that I believe David wrote to that effect. Fret not yourselves because of evildoers. He starts out by saying, because when you look at the lay of the land and you see folk prospering, people who ostensibly don't follow the God of the Bible, we say, like one of the princes of Saudi Arabia, you know, he's just slightly less wealthy than $20 billion. Just slightly. He just, it dipped a little bit under $20 billion, he says. I saw this report on 60 Minutes last week, and I mean, he lives in the absolute lap of luxury. No question about it. Now, I'm not saying that he's an evil person, but there are people who pray, you know, more than maybe five times a day, or people who are tithers to the nth degree, and yet they don't live like that. They are viewed as righteous. Well, there's an entire book that is a most misunderstood book, because the notion of it, or the theme, people conclude, is the problem of suffering. It's called the Book of Job. But Job is a man of mystery. There are things we don't know about Job. And I want to go through the book not in a critical analysis, not in a in-depth study. There are 42 chapters of the book, so we could not do it in our time together today, but it raises some interesting questions, I think, that we can consider. One of the things about the book of Job is the way it's laid out. It has an interesting outline, if you will. There's a prologue, there's an epilogue, and then in the middle, the core of the book, is something called a prose poetic disputation. That's a fancy way of saying it's a poem with an argument. It's an argument that takes place from chapters 3 through chapter 42. And the people who are making the argument, or who are establishing the conflict or the disputation, there's Job with his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. These are his three friends who came to check on him when they heard, and we all hear about tragedy happening to people, or they're in a situation where they need to be visited, and we go to see about them, and sometimes what we see takes our breath away. And sometimes we hardly know what to say, because the tragedy or the suffering that they're experiencing is so egregious and so difficult. What do you say? What words should come out of your mouth? So these three friends are there, but later on, a young man who's kind of sitting on the side listening to all of their conversation, as young people ought to do, but don't do today. They all have opinions about everything. But then this young man, Elihu, is sitting and listening to the elders talk and ruminate and argue about who caused this. Is this from the hand of God? And what evil have you done, Job, that you're not confessing to? Because God doesn't cause people to suffer when they are righteous. Is that true? Is that a true analysis? Well, the book of Job begins to address some of those things. But the biggest disputation that comes in chapter 38 is when God himself shows up to have a conversation with Job. So this lays out the book. You've got a prologue, chapters 1 and 2. An epilogue, which is chapter 42 from verses 7 through 17, or the end of the book. But in the middle of it, you've got this argument, this disputation going on. And we can learn some things, I believe, by taking a look at it. But this mystery man, Job, extremely mysterious. Now, there are three places in the Bible that the name Job appears, outside of the book of Job. And that's interesting because I want to go to the first one first, over in Genesis, the 46th chapter. Because it raises a question that you and I can consider. I don't have the answer for you because there's nowhere in the Bible that gives you the answer. But a name shows up in chapter 46 of Genesis and verse 14, and the name is Job. Now, he is one of the sons of one of the 12 sons of Israel, of the 12 sons of Jacob, and he is a son of Issachar. This Issachar was a son by Leah. You find that earlier on in the events of the birth of the 12 children of, actually the 13 children of Jacob. He had a daughter named Diane. And here's the name mentioned, the sons of Issachar, Tola, Phuva, and Job, and Shimron. Now, is this the same Job? I can't tell you. But the writers of the investigators of the book of Job, while they question when Job may have lived, there is no date on the book of Job to determine it, but they feel he was probably he was in the patriarch period of time, that he would have lived maybe at the time of Abraham, certainly maybe among the times of the tribes, of the 12 tribes, which if he lived among the 12 tribes, here is his name, when the 12 tribes lived. Or the fathers of the 12 tribes, you know. Issachar was one of the sons of Jacob. Was Job one of those? I have no evidence to tell you that he was not, nor do I have evidence to tell you that he was. But there is his name for your consideration. Because then, when the setting is given in the first chapter as to this man being a man who lived in the land of Uz, well, where is Uz? Well, the Bible tells us where Uz is. And Uz is not in the land of Oz, where the wizard lives. So, Uz is a real place in real time, and it is associated, as I'll show you here in a moment, with the land of Edom or Arabia in that region of time. One could say that if this Job in Genesis is the same Job here in this book, did he leave Egypt at some point in time? Because when we are introduced to this Job in chapter 46 of Genesis, he is among those 70 people who go from Canaan into Egypt to meet with their brother Joseph, to be reunited with Joseph. So this is a Job to consider. When we find out where Uz is, then the question can be, well, did he leave Egypt at some point in time and wind up in Edom or in the Arabian area further away? Perhaps he did, and carried some great wealth with him because he was quite a wealthy man in cattle and herds and that sort of thing. So these are some of the mysteries about Job that we need to consider. Now, the second place that Job is mentioned is in the book of Ezekiel. Let's turn over to Ezekiel, the 14th chapter. And he's mentioned in a context here of two very obviously righteous individuals, chapter 14 and verse 14. The context is speaking of the tragedies that are going to be visited upon the sinning people, those who trespass grievously, verse 13 says. And Ezekiel is supposed to tell about this, and primarily we're talking about the city of Jerusalem. Son of Man, in verse 13, when the land sins against me by trespassing grievously, then will I stretch out mine hand upon it, and will break the staff of the bread, cause famine thereof, and I will send famine upon it, and will cut off man and beast from it. Though, verse 14, these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, though these people who are mentioned here were in this land of Jerusalem, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, says the Lord God. They can't save anybody else. They can't have their righteousness be spread out for other people. They could only save themselves if they were in this city at that time. Well, this gives us notion that Job was a real person, not a figment of someone's imagination. We know Noah was real. We know Daniel was real. In fact, Ezekiel is a contemporary of Daniel. Daniel is sitting hobnobbing with Nebuchadnezzar while Ezekiel is a prisoner of war, if you will. So Ezekiel knew about Daniel during this period of time, and he selects to name, or God pronounces through Ezekiel, that if Noah, Daniel, or Job were in the city that was going to be destroyed, they could only save themselves. Verse 20 is a repeating of the fact that there's a Noah, Daniel, and Job. So is Job a real person? Well, Ezekiel is a testimony in pinning what God is saying to him and what message he wants Ezekiel to have and to deliver. All right? Now, the interesting thing about the mentioning of these three people, we know Noah was a flawed individual, don't we? Got drunk after the flood, planted a vineyard, and had a little too much grape, and got a little high, a little tipsy, a little whacked out, so drunk that a sexual impropriety was perpetuated against him, and he didn't realize it until he awakened from his stupor. So was Noah a perfect man? No, he was not. Daniel is a little harder for us to analyze because we have no record in the book of Daniel of Daniel being an unrighteous man or having flaws. All we know is that Daniel prayed in chapter 9 before God, and he says, he included himself, have sinned. So Daniel at least knew within himself he was flawed. But we have no evidence of what the flaws might have been like we do Noah. So here are three individuals mentioned, Noah, Daniel, and Job. The question is, was Job a perfect man? Or was he flawed? That was the question that his friends began to present to him, as we'll see here in a moment. Job, within his own self, while confessing that I'm a sinful man and so forth and so on, but I wish God would tell me what my sin is, because Job didn't realize what his sin was. He thought he was a righteous man, and we'll see a description by the narrator of the in the prologue about this man, Job. And so he was flawed, but he didn't realize what his flaw was. When I was in the Old Testament survey and studying the Old Testament and the book of Job, it was time to go into that. The teacher, David John Hill, said something quite profound about the book. And when you read and begin to study what the analyzers and the critics say about the book of Job, they throw their hands up in the air and say, well, we really don't know what the point of the book is. And that's because the point of the book is the problem that they have. In fact, Satan didn't know what Job's problem was. Because Satan had the same problem that Job had. And so generally, when you have that problem that Job had, you can't see it. And what the problem was self-righteousness. Self-righteousness. That is, I'm doing everything right. I fast, I tithe, I go to church, I do everything right, so it can't be me. Well, if it can't be you, who can it be? Well, it must be God, if he's causing me to suffer. If I'm having these things come upon me, it must be God, it can't be me. And that's the discussion of the book, so the critics look at it and say, I don't know what the point of this book is. Well, it's usually because they're looking at their righteousness in comparison to God, and they feel that God is out of step with them because they are righteous in some kind of way. That's what the critics say. Now, you and I reading the book, would we say the same thing? Well, let's see. Let's see as we take a look at this book. Job was a real person. Now, let's look to see and verify that Uz, which is mentioned in chapter 1 and verse 1 of Job, let's see if it's a real place. Jeremiah, the 25th chapter, and let's look at verse 20. Jeremiah 25. And in the context, again, verse 15 sets that up. For thus says the Lord God of Israel unto me, take the wine cup of this fury at my hand, and cause all the nations to whom I send you to drink it. He took the cup in verse 17 at the Lord's hand, and made all the nations to drink unto whom the Lord had sent me, to wit, and now he was going to name the places where he was sent, to Jerusalem, to the cities of Judah, and to the kings thereof, and the princes thereof, to make them a desolation and an astonishment, and hissing and a curse, as it is this day. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and his servants, and his princes, and all his people, while they were drinking of the cup also. And all the mingled people, and all the kings of the land of Uz, a real place. And all the kings of the land of the Philistines, and Ashkelon, and Azah, and Ekron, and the remnant of Ashdod, Edom, Moab, and the children of Ammon. See, all of these places were to drink of this cup that God had placed. Now, Jeremiah gives us further information about Uz in Lamentation. That's right after the book of Jeremiah. And verse chapter 4, verse 21. And this is why when you're trying to figure out where Uz is, this gives the strongest indication. Verse 21, it says, rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, that dwellest in the land of Uz. So where is Uz? Well, it's associated with Edom. Edom is another name for Esau. And who was Esau? He was the twin brother of Jacob. So that gives you a connotation and a context of where Job may have dwelt and among whom he may have dwelt and his relationship, which makes his mention in the book of Genesis relevant, if that is the same Job. Now, years ago, back in the Worldwide Church of God days, we had used to have an article about a man named Cheops, and it was speculated that that was a Babylonian, I think, name for Job. And of course, Cheops was the builder of pyramids, and so people got to speculating that, well, Job was a great man. He was probably the builder of the pyramids. Well, there's no biblical record that that is true, but out in secular history, that this has been an attempt. That was an attempt back in those days to suggest that he was. We know there was a Job who went to Egypt. It's mentioned there in Genesis 46. Where he went after that, did he wind up in Uz, in Edom? Well, it could be, but I can't say of a surety. But we do know there was a real Job. We've got that clear. And we do know that it was a real land of Uz. Now, let's go to the book of Job. As I said, generally, the theme is thought to be the problem of suffering. Not that there isn't suffering, there is. We see that all around us. But the problem is, who gets it? Who causes it? Why is there suffering? And especially to people who appear to be righteous or, you know, they're not evil people. Their motives are just and their motives are pure. Let's begin in chapter 1 here. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright. I mean, that's what we're hit with right off the bat. Perfect and upright, and one that feared God, reverenced God, was in awe of God, respected God, and eschewed evil. He disregarded evil. He didn't want to have anything to do with evil. Now, that's a description of a guy you kind of like to have as a neighbor. You know, this is a pretty good fella right here. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep, 300, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and very great household. So that this man was the greatest of all the men of the east. Well, we know now, in relationship to Jerusalem, this would have been east of there, and Uz and Edom is east of there. So he was of the east. All right? Sons sent out, went out one day, feasted in their houses, everyone his day, perhaps a birthday, in their houses, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all, at least 10 offerings Job would make. It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts, and this is how Job lived, just in case. This is a cautious man. This is a man aware and careful about what is done and what God might be displeased with. Now, a man this careful, if he thought he slipped up, he was going to do something about it. He was going to have a sacrifice or something, to show God, just in case. You ever have a just in case sin? A prayer like, Lord, I don't think I've done anything today, but just in case, please forgive me. One of those kind of things. Anybody ever pray just in case? You know, you got through a pretty good day, and just in case. Well, that was Job. Cautious. So, this sets the stage for what will happen. You've heard this in times past, and it is a remarkable prologue, and the narrator of the prologue is also the narrator, or we guess the same narrator at the end of the book, at the epilogue. This is not the voice of Job. This is not written by Job. We don't even know who wrote the book of Job, for that matter. But this narrator is now going to describe something, and I want us to take it personally, this description that we're going to see here. Because if it happened then, is it possible that this kind of discussion could go on in heaven now? It says, now there was a day, perhaps the day is past, perhaps it's not happening now, but just in case, maybe it is. Now there was a day when the sons of God, angels, came to present themselves before Yahweh, the Eternal. And Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, this is so interesting to me, and I hope it is to you, Satan did not bring up Job. None of the angels brought up Job. It was the Creator who brought up Job by saying, where have you been, Satan? Well, Satan answered and said, well, from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down it. So where does Satan go to and fro and walk up and down it? Right here on the earth. Hanging out. Checking us out. And especially the people of God, he checks out. All right? And the Lord said unto Satan, here's where Job is brought up, have you considered my servant Job? Wow. Wait a minute. Let me read that again. Have you considered my servant Bronson? Put your name in there. Put your name in there. There is none like him in the earth. A perfect and upright man, one that fears God and eschews evil. And then Satan gives a response, and this is the response that you want to hear going on with your name in the conversation. All right? Well, does Job fear you for nothing? Is he doing it for nothing? I mean, verse 10, have you not made a hedge about him? Haven't you protected him? About his house, about all that he has on every side? So when we're talking about the protection of God, how far does it extend? Is it just our person? Well, he describes his house, his property. Everything about Job, everything that is connected to Job, his family, everything is under the divine protection of God. This is what Satan says. And if he did it for Job, can he do it for you? You see, I went over the other day. They totaled out my car from the accident that I had, and so I went over to take a look at it, and the lady showing it to me over at Davis Green says, wow, you sure had some protection, you see, because it was all crushed in on the driver's side, you know, and she said, somebody looked like they could have been hurt in this. Well, I wasn't hurt. Car is totaled. But, you see, God can do that. And it certainly happened just before the feast, and I had to think about that in the light of, well, the first thing that came to my mind when the car stopped spinning was, I've got to go leave for the feast on Monday. And I got this car thing. Plus, I had a wedding to perform that evening. That was the second thought. I'm not going to get to the wedding now. But God does protect, and that's what he is conveying, or Satan is conveying to God. You know, you determine the bounds of what I can do. And what havoc I can wreak can only be, you can thwart it, you can tell me how far to go. And that's what then pursues through this conversation. It says here, and his substance is increased in the land, in the verse 2. Verse 11 says, but put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. Notice the way this is stated. Put forth your hand, God, and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, he doesn't even respond to the statement that Satan makes. He doesn't say, well, I'm going to touch him. Here's what the Lord says to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, Satan. It's in your power. I'm giving you latitude only upon himself. Put not forth your hand. You see, it's important how carefully you read these things to understand that sometimes we attribute to God things that he does not do. We attribute to God things that he only permits. So whose hand reached out to the towers in New York? Was it God's or was it Satan? We know God permitted. Whatever happens, there has to be a permission from God, even in the suffering of our physical bodies. Does God cause us to be ill and to suffer, or does he permit it, and for what purpose? That's the whole discussion that goes on in the book of Job. Why was this thing happening to Job? Well, before we get into Job's view of it, and before we get into his friend's view of it, we have the setup. That's what the prologue is. It's the setup to the rest of the story. All right. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord, and then we have the account of what happens to not only his property, but his family and everything that he has. A great, horrific thing, and it was one thing after another. There was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and there came a messenger from Job and said, the oxen were plowing, and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabians, who were a neighboring tribe, fell upon them, took them away. Yes, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell you. And while he was speaking, you're talking about news, there's an old joke about the guy who, his neighbor was supposed to watch his dog or something like that, so he begins to tell him all of the tragic things that happened. The house caught a fire, you know, robbers came in, all kinds of horrific things, one after another, and ultimately ends up, and of course, your dog died too, kind of thing, because they were, one after another, these things progressed. While he was yet speaking, there came also another, verse 16, and the fire of God. Now, was it the fire of God? One has to be very careful how you read the Bible. It was not the fire of God. It was Satan. But it was attributed to God because fire came from the sky, lightning, if you will. We have this notion about acts of God. They're in our insurance policies and so forth. An act of God, a flood, hurricane, tornadoes, are acts of God. Well, was it the fire that came and fell from heaven and it burned up the sheep and the servants? Was it of God? Well, what was the discussion that went on with Satan? It's in your power, Satan. All right? That's how you got to understand how things happen sometimes. So there are things that are attributed to God which are not God's at all, but are the hand of Satan, because God has a greater purpose and he is using Satan to effect that purpose. Boy, it's wonderful to know that. It gives you great confidence that if you're in the hand of God, Satan can only squeeze so far. It's trying, it's testing, it's suffering, but it is not beyond repair of God, because he is more powerful than the enemy, the adversary. That's what Satan means, the adversary. I am alone escaped, verse 16, to tell you. And while he was speaking, there came another that said, the Chaldeans. And, you know, this tells you more about the location. The Chaldeans are in the area of Iraq. Iraq, in that particular region. That's where the Chaldeans are from. And that was also where Abraham was from. Ur of the Chaldees. All right? The Chaldeans made out three bands and fell upon the camels and carried them away. Yes, the slain, the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only have escaped. And while he was speaking, another said, your sons and your daughters, seven sons, three daughters, were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I only am escaped alone to tell you. Job's response to all of this tragedy is one that is often cited. It's one of these pithy sayings from the book of Job that are taken out of context many times. They are totally taken out of context. And one of the greatest scriptures that are taken out of context, that is taken out of context, is in Job 14, dealing with resurrection. There's truth there, but it's usually taken out of the context. See, that's part of an argument or disputation that's going on in the mind of Job with his friends. We'll see that in a few moments. So here's Job's response. He rose up, rent his mantle, shaved his head, fell down upon the ground and worshipped. And he said, this profound thing, naked came I in of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. Well, what, to his mother's womb? No. He's going to be naked. Wherever he's going, he's not going to return to his mother's womb. Even Nicodemus knew that. You can't do that, big fella. Okay. So he is not saying, well, I came out naked from my mother's womb, and I'm going to wherever I'm leaving to, I'm going to be naked, unclothed. And the Lord has taken away. The Lord has taken away. Well, did the Lord take away? Or was it Satan? So analyzing sayings and statements from the Bible have to be taken in the context. Otherwise, you could take that scripture out, and I've heard it quoted many times by many preachers, you know, about the issue of suffering. God has done it. I got to endure it. Well, you may have to endure it, but attributing it to God may not be the wisest thing. Here it is. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That was his response, because he didn't know from whence the trouble was coming. He didn't have an idea. In all this, Job sinned not nor charged God foolishly. And then I take a little biblical license and I write in my margin, yet. Yet. Because that statement by itself is to declare that Job was so righteous, so upright, so perfect, that God was not justified to even permit Satan to do what he did to it. And later God shows up to tell and declare that he was within his sovereign right to do what was done or permit what was done to Job. That's a big lesson to learn. And that was the lesson that Job had to learn. So the statement, in all of this Job sinned not, he didn't transgress the law, nor charge God foolishly, well, he didn't yet. Because he is going to make some foolish charges later to God. Now, chapter 2 is then, of course, the fact that he's going to... Satan goes back and has the same conversation with God. Well, he hasn't cursed you yet. I took everything of his wealth and so forth, but you let me touch his body. God gave him permission to touch his body with a sickness. But he gave him a limitation. You can't take his life. Because I want something to happen with Job that you, Satan, cannot see, that Job cannot see, but I've got something I'm working on here. And that is wonderful to know.
Rebecca, to know that God is working on something that is beyond our comprehension. What's happening in New York, what happened in New York, what's happening in the world, God is working on some things. But you don't have to, well, come up with all kinds of scenarios and schemes to make it happen. God is pretty plain about it. And the book of Job helps us to see it. That there's a real Satan, a real adversary, whom God uses for his purposes. Satan has no authority that is not granted to him by God. He has limitations, even in death. Because death is an ultimate enemy that will be destroyed, says the Bible. It is going to be cast ultimately into the pit. And death itself will be destroyed, and there will be triumph even over death. Though Satan has it in his power now to exercise it. Now, already I see that this is impossible to do in one sermon. I see the impossibility of it, so I'm going to make it a two-parter. I'm going to speak on the 17th, and I'm going to continue with some things about it. But I want to get into the first disputation here. There are three of them. From chapters 3 through chapter 42, there are three disputes with his three friends. Then there's a fourth dispute with Elihu, and then there is the big ultimate dispute with God himself, where God comes down and begins to ask Job some questions. But I just want to deal with the first dispute in the time remaining today. And that begins in verse 3, chapter 3. But notice the end of chapter 2. Sometimes things can come on us so hard and so strong that it literally takes our breath away. It shuts our mouths. Look at what happens in verse 11 of chapter 2. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this evil, and it's interesting how they characterize it. This is the narrator's voice speaking. This is just absolute evil being perpetuated. What is described about September 11th? Ultimate evil. Horrific evil. Evil people. Evil, evil, evil. And so, where does evil come from? Who is the author of evil? Well, you put the D on evil and you got what? Devil. That's what you got. So, attributing evil to God in the sense that he creates evil, well, there's a scripture that says, I create evil. Well, he created Satan, certainly he did that. In other words, I think the statement is, I am responsible for evil. God is ultimately responsible for everything, no question about it, because he's in control. He is sovereign. So his friends categorize it as evil that came upon him. They came everyone from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamanite, for they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. They had been communicating. Have you heard what happened to our friend Job? Well, let's get together and go by and see him and give him some encouragement to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, well, what they saw was not recognizable. Have you ever visited anyone who does not look like themselves because of an illness that has been imposed upon them? Sure. They didn't recognize this Job. They lifted up their voice and wept. And they rent everyone his mantle and sprinkled dust upon their head towards heaven. In other words, they took a handful of dust and they threw it up in the air over their heads and it trickled down upon them. That is the sign of being in mourning. So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. That takes your breath away when you see some stuff that is just horrible. I look back on World War II historically, and the greatest generation, as Tom Brokaw describes it, you know, it is hard to get veterans of that war to talk about it. They saw such horrific stuff, paralyzing stuff, that they just don't talk about it. And if it were not for certain historians who dig it out of them, drag them out of it, how much would we know, ultimately? Ask the families of veterans of of wars, you know, how much they would describe. Had a friend from Vietnam. He showed me some pictures one time, which as soon as he showed them to me, took them away from him and said, you don't need to be seeing that. And they were something that would take your breath away. So the fact that they are sitting there 7 days and seven nights in the presence of Job, who's under this great suffering, indicates how deep it was and how pervasive it was. So they sat there with it for 7 days and seven nights, not uttering a word. And then after that period of time, Job opens his mouth. And this is what is so astounding, because it is a natural response that is recorded here. Job said, when he opened his mouth, he cursed his day. What does that mean? Well, the day he was born. He's going to explain it here. Job spake and said, let the day perish wherein I was born. I've had moments in my life, I don't know about you, when I've said, boy, I wish I wasn't even born. Anybody here know what I'm talking about? I wish I wasn't drawing breath. So it's a natural thing to say such a thing. And the night in which I was said, there is a man-child conceived. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. The first outburst after 7 days and seven nights of silence is, I wish I had never been born. That's suffering. That is pitiful. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize upon it. I mean, he is taking that 24-hour period of time, the day and the night portion of it, and saying, I wish it were blotted out. I wish it had never happened. He's lost his 10 children. He's lost all of his property. He's lost everything, and his health also. He has come to the depths. He is at the pit. He is at the bottom of despair. Verse 11. Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent? The margin says, receive me. Why did I, why was I dangled on my mother's knees, so to speak? And why the breast that I should suck? Why? For now should I have lain still and been silent, stillborn or something. I should have slept, then had I been at rest. And he goes on like this, on and on with his analysis. Verse 25, for the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. You know, that's a truth there to consider. The thing that we fear comes upon us. How many times has that happened when you thought, oh, I sure hope this doesn't happen to me, and sure enough it happens? Is that the power of positive or negative thinking? Well, you know, you can put a label on it however you choose to, but as a man thinketh, so is he, said Jesus Christ. As a man or a woman thinketh, so is he. So we have to be careful what we think, careful what we say, what comes out of our mouth, because here's a testimony of Job. I was afraid that something bad was going to happen to me. That's why I lived the way I did. Sacrifices, living righteously, just in case. He was not living in victory, in triumph. That was not how he lived his life. He was a cautious man. A cautious in the sense that, well, something bad is bound to happen. I just better, you know, make sure I'm on God's good side. I was not in safety, verse 26, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came. You know, an unquiet spirit, up in arms, up in upheaval, wake up during the night thinking, oh, let's see now, did I put out the cat? Did I put the dog out? Did I lock the front door? You know, is the alarm on the car? You know, all kinds of stuff. Did I turn the coffee pot off at work? You know, all the kinds of things that trouble us. That was Job's experience. And so he makes his case in chapter 3. And then his friends begin the discourse, and I'm going to save this to next time. What I will do in the next sermon is this. I want to look at that first disputation, where Eliphaz talks, where Bildad talks, where Zophar talks, and we'll kind of examine some of the things that are said. That'll carry us up to chapter 14, where the profound statements are made about the resurrection. And I want to look at those, and basically it's a continuation in the next two disputations. But we want to get the mind of Job and how he responds to his friends, because his friends are going to say to him, Job, you've done something wrong. You need to fess up. You got something secret going on that you're not confessing. Otherwise, this stuff wouldn't happen to you. Now, we are in the luxury seat of having read the prologue and understand that God set it up for his purpose. And his purpose becomes evident in chapter 42. What God was intending is what we learn at the end of the book. But he's setting it up, but his friends are unaware of it. That's why when we go and visit people in despair and distress and in suffering, we have to be careful about what we say, because we will be judged by what we say. As his friends are going to be judged, and God has something to say to them later on about how much they blew it, as they were sitting around ruminating, well, I wonder, why did God let that happen? Why did she get cancer? And why did this person die? And so forth. And we have our opinions, just like Job's friends had it. And we're so wrong most of the time as to the why. So we're going to examine that. And then we're going to find God showing up on the scene in chapter 38 with a profound way. And many of the critics look at that and they say, well, I don't know what the reason God showed up for. Well, I mean, why did he show up? I mean, what's the point of his showing up, you know? And it seems out of context, as one of the commentators said. Now, before I leave you today, just want to read this in summation. This is regarding the prologue that we've looked at. It says, the subject is as old as the hills and as modern as the space age. If God is just and good, why does he let innocent people suffer? And parenthetically it says, why the casual victims of war and terrorism? Why the child dying of cancer? As a man, Job is really good. Really. About the best any man could ever hope to be, yet calamity overwhelms him. Loss of possessions and family is followed by grim, prolonged physical suffering that shakes his faith to the depths. This is what you get in Eerdmans' Handbook of the Bible and the Book of Job. And that's a pretty good description. The question is, why do bad things happen to good people? We'll get to the answer on the 17th, the next time we come together for worship. So God be with you in your suffering, because he can bring you out more than conquerors, says the Scriptures.